Hello and welcome to Investigating the Post Office Scandal. I'm Nick Wallace, the author of the book, The Great Post Office Scandal. This is episode 7, an interview with Dr. Hannah Quirk. I'm doing the introductions all by myself this week as my co-host Rebecca Thompson is on holiday, which is outrageous, I know. But even whilst away, she had a hand in quite a significant piece of journalism last weekend as a contributing reporter to an excellent expose by Sabah Meddings in the Sunday Times. Sabah interviewed Jarnail Singh, a former post office lawyer who features a lot in my book. He has questions to answer and Sabah got him to answer some of them. So do have a look at the story if you can. It's called Should Those Who Sent the Postmasters to Prison Now Face Court Themselves? Sabah, Rebecca and Hugo's piece also reveals that Paul Marshall, a lawyer who helped persuade the Court of Appeal that the Post Office's actions in prosecuting innocent people was an affront to the public conscience, has written to the Director of Public Prosecutions asking him to investigate those at the Post Office and Fujitsu who he says may have perverted the course of justice by failing to disclose evidence. Right, now let's focus on the main content for this episode. It is an interview with Dr. Hannah Quirk, a reader in criminal law at King's College London. She has a special interest in miscarriages of justice. Hannah used to work at the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which has played a significant role in overturning some of the postmaster's convictions. She's interested in researching the post office case in order to identify the lessons that can be learned from it, and is also interested in exploring the possible differences in the way that non-white postmasters have been treated compared to white postmasters. Rebecca started by asking Dr. Quirk about her job and what it entails.
I'm an academic. I work at King's College in London, and my main areas are criminal law and criminal justice, and I've got a particular interest in miscarriages of justice. I used to work for the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is a government-funded body in Birmingham. It was the first one in the world that was set up to investigate when people said they'd been wrongly convicted of a crime or had been given an unfair sentence. So I worked for them for 4 years, which was a fascinating job. I loved it. And then when I became an academic, that was one of the areas that I wanted to focus on a bit more. So looking at how mistakes happen in the criminal justice system and what we can do to try and put things right.
So I can imagine the post office case is kind of ripe with opportunity for your work.
It's an extraordinary case.
How did you come across it?
It's one of those very rare examples where it cuts through to the public. So normally if I'm talking to students about miscarriages of justice, I started talking about the Birmingham Six, and then, which was obviously a huge influence. You know, I remember them being released from prison. It was a very striking influence on my career and my thinking about criminal justice. And then eventually I realised my students weren't even born when the Birmingham Six were released. It meant nothing to them. And we went from that period in the late 1980s, early 1990s, where it seemed everybody was aware of miscarriages of justice. There seemed to be one on the news every couple of weeks. Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, Stephen Kishko, Judith Ward, the M25-3. It just went on and on and on. And it built up this sense that something needed to change in criminal justice, which was partly how the Criminal Cases Review Commission was set up. But since then, that hasn't really happened. We've had the odd case that people might have read about in a Sunday newspaper, but there's been nothing that's really sort of grabbed the public attention in that way that I can think of. And I think also the fact that these were people who were so ordinary, you know, that everybody uses the post office. There was something in that, I think, that made it particularly shocking. And the fact that these people had, you know, were public servants and had suddenly been treated in this appalling way. It had that very, very unusual ability to cut through to the public. There's a professor at Oxford called Andrew Ashworth, and he's written about what he called catalytic cases, that are the cases that make a difference, that cause something to change. So in the early 20th century, there were a couple of cases that led to the Court of Appeal being set up, because up until then, there actually wasn't a Court of Criminal Appeal. Cases like James Hanratty, Ruth Ellis, Derek Bentley, Timothy Evans, they sort of helped change public opinion on the death penalty, because people realised if there was a risk you might execute someone who was innocent, then it wasn't safe to have the death penalty. The Birmingham Six type cases led to the Criminal Cases Review Commission being set up. So there's this, it's, and I don't know what it is about them. Sometimes it's just a fluke, or it's having a good journalist who picks up a story. But these cases suddenly get that cut through with the public. And if you're in the business of trying to get reform in the criminal justice system, these are very precious cases, because you don't get that public attention very often. So it's very important to try and, this sounds terrible, to use these cases to achieve reform. But most cases, people never hear about them. People are convicted, they may have their convictions quashed, they may spend years in prison, and it doesn't even get a line in the local paper. These cases have really achieved that shock. I mean, I've had people who don't really know what I do, or, you know, so you go to a family party and suddenly people think, oh, I do know what Hannah's talking about for once. You know, it's something that they want to tell me about it and what they thought about it, because it's so shocking and so upsetting. And I think that there's two separate issues. There's the personal horror of those cases, you know, of people losing their careers, their livelihoods, their homes, their families in some cases, their life savings. You know, all of that are individual tragedies that hopefully we could all empathize with, if not really imagine what it must be like. And then probably from an academic point of view, or a practitioner point of view, how the hell did this happen? So what were the structural things that went wrong? So who were the people commissioning these projects who weren't overseeing it, who knew there were mistakes, who covered up those mistakes, who allowed prosecutions to go ahead, you know, the incentives on people to plead guilty, even though they knew they hadn't done it. That kind of plea bargaining issue is a huge problem in the United States. It's generally seen as less of a problem in this country, but clearly was a factor in these cases. And then actually uncovering these miscarriages of justice, it was really the civil actions that the sub-postmasters took that started this process of unpicking what had gone wrong. And without that, I'm not sure the criminal convictions could or would have been overturned. We've got the legal aid issues, the fact that they weren't entitled to legal representation. So they've had to cobble that money together, the lack of compensation. I mean, these are all really, really, you know, if I was teaching a course on miscarriages of justice, this is a week each, you know, this is a lecture, this is an essay, this is an exam topic. There's so much in this case. And I think we owe it to ourselves as a country, and also to these people who were wrongly convicted, to learn every single lesson we can from this case, because it's got everything.
So has your work on the case been quite broad so far? I mean, it sounds like you've been focusing on every aspect, although the reason obviously I wanted to speak to you in the first place was to relate it to the ethnicity angle. It sounds like you've looked into or starting to look into every part of this.
I would start a project. You sort of have a sweep across to think about what's interesting. And obviously there's other people working in this area too. So it's partly what different skills can we bring to it. But again, what I think one of the fascinating things has been, I've been contacted by colleagues who work in different areas of law and saying, this is a really exciting case to work on. So again, in terms of, I don't do anything on civil law normally. You know, the civil actions that were brought against post office. So I've got colleagues working in that area saying they think there'd be some really interesting ways of looking at the overlaps between those two issues. People working in you know, data protection and those kind of areas of law, there's links. People who are looking at how we regulate the legal profession, what's a lawyer's professional responsibility if they're employed by a company that's asking them to do something that seems a bit questionable ethically, what are their responsibilities there? Disclosure is a huge issue. So this was something I started looking at as part of my PhD, so a long time ago. And that's when the police and prosecution are investigating a case, they've got to show the defence everything that they're going to use as part of the prosecution case. What happens to all the other material, though, is a bit of a question. Now, the defence almost never has the same kind of access to information as the police and prosecution, because the police can go and seize hard drives, they can question witnesses, they can, you know, stop and search people. They've got all these huge powers. So what they're supposed to do is have a look at all the material that they don't want to use and then put that on different lists or schedules, whether it might be useful to the defence or they don't think it's of any use at all. So let's say they've, in a case like this, they've seized all the till receipts from a post office. Now, they might say in 35,000 pages, there's nothing of interest in there. So that these are the dates where there were no questions about anything having gone wrong. So it might just stay on the list, you know, till reconciliations, 1st of January to 31st of December 2010. If there's something in there that they don't want to use, but they think that might help the defence case, then they're supposed to put that on a list, and then the prosecution look at it and decide if the defence actually get to see it or not. So lots of miscarriages of justice have been overturned by stuff that's been found in that material. So if you're a police officer or a prosecutor looking at something with your prosecution hat on, it might not look important to you. But if you're a defence solicitor, you might think, that's interesting. That doesn't quite tally with what this person says. I could investigate this, or that could help undermine what the prosecution witness is saying. So disclosure is really important. And it seems in this case, quite a lot of material wasn't disclosed that should have been.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that, because I'm working on a story at the moment based on a letter that Paul Marshall has written to the DPP, asking them to investigate perversion of the course of justice, and it's centred around this issue of disclosure. So he's saying it was deliberate rather than inadvertent.
Right. So yeah, that's a different issue. Now, that does happen, and again, that's almost quite an old-fashioned miscarriage of justice in a way. So in the 1970s, we had cases where either the police beat confessions out of people, or they sat on evidence that wasn't helpful to their case, or at times actually fabricated evidence as well. That's been much less common in recent years. I think generally disclosure failings have been because the police and the prosecution and the defence are all overworked and underpaid. Obviously the barristers are on strike at the moment, and they do an awful lot of work unpaid that's just combing through material to see if there's anything that might be useful. If you're talking about actual cover-ups of material, that's very frightening, and takes us into very different territory, that you've got a professional. And again, I think that there's possibly, from what we know from previous cases, that there's different ways of doing this. There's the, I am going to fit this person up for whatever reason. I'm going to, so there was a police squad in the 70s that used to go around planting guns in people's bedrooms. They'd go in and search the house, and then, oh, look what we found under the bed. We're arresting you for an armed robbery. Or there were cases, there was an awful case, one in particular called Stefan Kishko, which was a man who was wrongly convicted of the sexual assault and murder of a little girl. And he was infertile. And the police knew from one of the scientific tests that was done that the person who'd murdered the little girl had a low sperm count, but he was fertile. So there was no way it could have been Kishko. But they and the scientists sort of persuaded themselves that there was a way of this being possible, and they were going to sit on the evidence. Now, it can be, the police at the time called it things like noble cause corruption. If they thought they had the right person, they would sort of bend the facts to get what they thought was the right result. Now, that's is wrong, obviously. From a human perspective, you can understand that, except, of course, when they think they've got the right person and they haven't, is the obvious danger with that approach. But yes, that's maybe different to the deliberately setting out to fit somebody up. I mean, again, this is what seems so extraordinary about the case, is that nobody seemed to think, isn't this a bit curious, that suddenly all these previously people of good character have suddenly all started stealing from the tills the moment we introduced this new computer system. Now, I don't know if that meant they thought this level of corruption was going on anyway, and this was just helping them to find out. But it can be a mindset as an investigator. If you think you know what the result is, that can blind you to seeing warning flags. And if you choose to push ahead, regardless of those warning flags, that can lead to terrible consequences, which is why we need really good training for investigators and prosecutors. And actually thinking about this again, sorry, this is another issue as to why this case is so interesting. The post office was the prosecutor. We didn't have an independent prosecution service. So the post office was the victim, supposedly, and also the prosecutor, which is a massive conflict of interest. I can talk about lots of, a very rational approach to law and criminal justice. When my house got burgled, that all went out of the window. I thought all kinds of terrible things should happen to the people who'd done that. You shouldn't be a judge in your own cause. And the police and the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, have made huge strides in professionalising their investigations. And I suppose when you've got a very small unit who know each other, who believe that their employers are the victim of this wrong, it becomes, they're less disinterested, and that can be dangerous. We need checks and balances in these systems. There's lots of problems with having an adversarial criminal justice system where one side fights against the other side, but it tests the weaknesses in your case.
Do you think it's as far as there shouldn't be private prosecutions, or should it, there just not be private prosecutions where the organisation is the victim?
So historically, prosecutions were private. So if something happened to me, then I would have to investigate and prosecute that case. Now, obviously, that doesn't work for most of us. We haven't got the capacity to investigate the case. You might be frightened of the suspect. You've got no legal knowledge. So the police took it over. And then after a lot of mistakes in the 70s, it was seen as there should be an independent prosecution service to act as a check on the police. So if you think the police go out and they investigate the crime, they're very involved with the case. It's important to have somebody saying, actually, have you got enough evidence there? Yeah, I know you think that person did it, and you can tell me all the terrible stuff they've done in their life. Have you actually got the cold, hard evidence for that? So that was why we introduced the Crown Prosecution Service. Certain organisations kept the power to bring private prosecutions, largely because of their expertise in an area. So we have serious fraud. The RSPCA has the power to bring prosecutions in animal cruelty cases. Post office obviously had those powers. Health and safety executive could bring private prosecutions. I can see an argument for having people with specialist knowledge, but there are also dangers in small units, and particularly in cases where you are the only, when you're the victim as well. So I think increasingly it would make sense for these cases to be run by the Crown Prosecution Service, and perhaps they could have oversight of a team of investigators within organisations that have the specialist knowledge.
Are there any other examples of this kind of organisational level of, I'm not sure what to call it, mistake or corruption, whether noble cause or not? Are there any other examples that come close to what's happened here? Do you know?
I can't think of anything. We've had sort of types of cases before, so things like the sudden infant death syndrome cases, where primarily women were convicted of murdering their babies, when they had sudden infant death, and evidence was given by paediatricians that said certain signs were suggestive that the baby had been murdered. So if they had more than one sudden infant death in the family, or things like little hemorrhages in the baby's eyes, but that could actually, it turns out, also be a result of a traumatic labour. So as our scientific knowledge developed, we realised that a group of women had been convicted on evidence that couldn't be sustained anymore. But that was more, I think our knowledge had changed over time. We've had things like the sort of satanic abuse panics. What else might there have been? You have evidence where like one police squad has been corrupt, so, and you know, beaten confessions out of people or fabricated evidence, which then casts a doubt on many of the cases that, or all the cases that they've where they've achieved convictions. I can't think in terms of numbers of anything like this. Possibly the First World War soldiers who were shot for desertion, but they weren't miscarriages of justice under the law at the time. I think, you know, they're unfair now. Or the, gay men convicted under the public indecency legislation. But again, they were convicted properly under the law at the time. It's just now that we're saying they're miscarriages of justice because social mores have changed. I can't think of a comparable example. People being interrogated in Northern Ireland during the conflict there. But in terms of numbers, I don't think the convictions would have been as high.
And sort of given the work that you've done on it, on this case sort of so far, and like everything you know about it, do you believe that, I guess, overall, the post office as an institution or people within the post office believed in these people's guilt, or had, you know, or had convinced themselves of these people's guilt? Or do you believe that it was a kind of a cold, hard commercial strategy to protect Horizon because it was such an existential threat if Horizon was questioned?
I don't think it would be fair for me to comment on that. I think that's absolutely something that needs to be investigated by the public inquiry. It can be very easy to get swept up in an organisational culture. And as I said, sort of almost that confirmation bias. But we're talking about professional people here. And we also need to think about the structures of organisations that make it possible for people to voice those concerns. Because clearly people felt under pressure to continue with this investigation. But I think every organisation, in terms of good practice and morality, needs to have a culture where people can say, I've got concerns about this, this isn't right, and not feel that they're putting their career on the line, because that's not healthy for an organisation, and it can have catastrophic consequences for individuals, as we've seen in these cases. And then the consequences that will follow from that are obviously very different. If people are found to have deliberately covered up, then there will be professional ramifications for that, and others as well, perhaps.
So moving on to the question of ethnicity, and how you kind of became interested in that, can you tell me a little bit about that part of the story, that angle, I guess, and sort of where you're at with any work on that question?
I think it's a really fascinating issue. We have known for years that there are differences in the way in which different ethnic groups experience the criminal justice system. And it's very difficult to unpick because things can look on the face of it. More black people are convicted of this, or more white people get sentenced for this. But sometimes that can be due to other factors as well. Now, in a normal, if you've looked at all the cases in court, you've got so many different kinds of defendants and they've got so many different personal stories. It's quite hard to unpick that. I mean, there's different statistical methods where you can sort of control for some of these factors, but it's quite tricky. I think the post office case would be a brilliant case to analyse because these are people of good character. So you remove a lot of those confounding factors. They're all, you're not talking about like teenagers and, very elderly people. So there's a lot more similarities within that. So I think we could actually dig into that and find some really interesting data. And again, I've done this before with the riots in 2011. I did some work with a colleague looking at how people were treated at every single step of the criminal justice system. So the headline figure was all these rioters were getting really long prison sentences. Hurrah. So what we looked at was literally what happened from the moment they were arrested. So normally you wouldn't be arrested for stealing a donut. If you were arrested, you wouldn't be held in custody overnight. If you were held in custody overnight, you wouldn't be sent, you'd be bailed before you appeared at the magistrate's court. They got sent up to the Crown Court. So at every single stage, there was this uplift. And I thought it'd be interesting to do something like this with the post office case. So look at the offences they were charged with, because that can make a difference. So whether it was at fraud or was it a theft offence, did they plead guilty or not? That can make a difference to your sentencing. Whether or not whether they could pay the money back. So it could be something like, and again, this is all very early days speculation, but if you've got more family money and you could afford to repay some of the money that was supposed to be missing from the post office, that might reduce your sentence because it looked as though you were being helpful and paying money back. But it may be that some of the Asian families didn't have those kind of resources to do that. I don't know. But those are the kind of factors we might want to look at. There's been rumours for years about, you might get differences in charging decisions around the country. Now, again, that is removed if it's the post office taking all those decisions. But do different courts come up with different types of response? So if it's if we look at how magistrates' courts deal with it compared to the Crown Court, rural areas compared to cities, there might be disparities there. So I think we've got a decent number of cases, but they're similar enough that we can hopefully start to explore why are there different, or if there are indeed differences between the different ethnicities. And if we could identify that in this cohort of cases, then I think that could be a very powerful tool for looking at the broader debate in criminal justice, because normally people can say, well, it's too broad brush, or well, there's reasons for that. I think we could use this little case study for much more wide-ranging discussion afterwards.
And I guess there's two aspects to it. So firstly, how people were treated by the criminal justice system, but also were a higher number of Asian postmasters prosecuted in the first place, or were they targeted in the first place by the post office? So I guess there's sort of two institutions that it would be interesting to explore how they were treated.
Yes, you're right. So even the people that didn't actually, who were filtered out earlier on, so people who might want to say, well, yes, I had problems with when the Horizon system came in, but I just paid £15,000 and it went away. We might want to look at, so who was investigated, and then which were the cases they zoomed in on, and were there discrepancies there?
What stage are you at with this work? Is it kind of early days?
Very early days. Yeah. So trying to get data from the post office, which is proving difficult, obviously. But I think one of the things that I'd really like to do, sort of going back to the idea at the start, is getting colleagues together from different areas of law and discussing this, because I think it's something we don't very often get a chance to do. We sort of get into our own little, this is criminal law, this is tort law, this is commercial law. But actually take one case and say, there's so much in here, and really learn everything we can from it, because I think they are like sort of, I don't know, is black swan the right word? It's so awful what happened, and it's got caught the public attention. We need to use this to learn as much as we possibly can from it, because similar mistakes are happening in other areas, almost certainly. They'll never achieve this level of cut through. They'll never get this kind of attention. But if we can learn this from the post office case, then we can improve the criminal justice system. The one where, ironically, these people are at an advantage is the fact that a separate compensation scheme has been set up for them. Now, normally, if you're convicted of a crime in this country and you're acquitted at the first appeal, you get no compensation. If you spend years in prison, the Criminal Cases Review Commission look at your case and the case gets sent back to the Court of Appeal, you are still not entitled to compensation unless you can prove that you didn't do it, which is an impossibly high bar. So almost nobody receives compensation for being wrongly convicted in this country now. There are people who spent 15, 16 years in prison and they do not get a penny of compensation from the state, which is outrageous. And most people don't know this. You know, the law changed very quietly. There's a lot going on. That's fine. But I think we need to highlight how expensive and how difficult it is to get your conviction overturned, and the fact that you can be left with nothing. And if you think about what these people have been through, I mean, it's equivalent to, I don't know, being involved in a terrorist incident or something. You know, your whole life has been turned upside down. Your home has been searched, your business, you've been taken away from your family. You know, women have given birth in prison. You know, all these...
Commit suicide.
Yes, exactly. Relationships have broken up. People's children have grown up. They've become estranged. And suddenly, okay, you're released from prison. How do you get a job now? You know, particularly if you were a respectable pillar of the community and you've got a conviction for theft from your employer or false accounting, that's going to be very, very hard to rebuild your life. You've lost all your money, your life savings. You know, we owe it to these people you can't restore what they've lost, but to try and make things better. And we don't do that for most people who've been wrongly convicted. 99.9% of people get nothing. And that perpetuates the stigma. It leaves them in a position where they can't rebuild their lives because they've got no money, they've got no resources, they may have lost their families. So again, I think the lessons we can draw from this post office case can really benefit how we improve the entire criminal justice system.
Dr. Hannah Quirk, a reader in criminal law at King's College London. Many thanks to Hannah for speaking to Rebecca, and we look forward to seeing what she uncovers as she continues to work on the post office case. Now, I need to pull my finger out and get some interviews in the can for future podcasts before I go on holiday next week. Hopefully we'll have something up week commencing 15th of August. If not, you'll know I've failed to get any interviews together before then. But thank you very much either way for listening to Investigating the Post Office Scandal. This podcast is researched, produced, edited, presented and owned by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace, though we are kindly supported by Whistledown Productions, who occasionally provide us with their expertise and facilities. See you next time.